The people most fooled by the siren song of tyranny and oppression are the intellectuals and not the average Joes. That they're willing to buy into any idea because it confirms their biases, where the average person who goes to work every day is much more skeptical.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio 201, the podcast from Benjamin Franklin High School. My name is Angelo Fernando, and I have an interesting guest today. He's my neighbor and an English teacher, Mr. Don Meyer. Hello, Don.
Hello. Nice to be here.
So, Don, I know this is your first podcast. By the way, any podcast doesn't really know where it's going to go, but I guess knowing from your background, it's going to turn out well. So, you're going to listen to somebody who's traveled to more places than I know of. Don, you're an English teacher here, but you've lived in Italy, right? But you've also done some other travel.
Yes, I lived in Italy for just over a year, but also traveled around a couple of times, primarily through Europe.
Okay, so when you talk of Europe, you're talking of Eastern Europe, Western Europe?
Well, my first trip involved a certain amount of Eastern Europe because it was before the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of communism, and so went behind the Iron Curtain to Hungary, went to Tito's Yugoslavia, which doesn't exist anymore. Now it's 7 or 8 different republics. But then also primarily Western Europe, Italy, France, Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Greece, those kinds of places.
Wow, so you're like ticking off the European Union here. Now, as I said, I knew this is going to go to a good place because guess what? I've also been to places like Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and this was Tito's time and before the wall came down and all of that. But I was pretty young at that time, so I didn't take a lot of it in. But it seems like what you have experienced is actually helping you in the kind of material that you work with, right, in English?
I think definitely that the fact that I've traveled, seen, and met other people, lived with different cultures, primarily in Italy, but also to a certain extent for a while in Germany, it really does help inform my teaching. Not that I bring all of that into the classroom, but the fact that I've had those different experiences helps, I think, to relate to literature in general, because every work of literature is another experience, if that makes sense.
It's sometimes we like to tell students, and I'm sure you tell students, that you learn more from experience than from books, even though we teach literature. You had learned Italian?
Well, I went to Italy to learn Italian. My goal was, after I started my first 2 years of college, I'm going to digress here a little bit, I was a chemistry major focusing on pre-med. I was planning on going into perhaps research medicine. But junior year, I had a great English class for people who were not English majors, and I had been questioning whether that was where I wanted to go in terms of medicine, and then just made an abrupt change junior year at ASU and became an English major. Realized I still needed to read a ton of books after I finished my bachelor's and went straight to my master's. And so when I was finishing that, I was working with an advisor, and we were talking about possible doctoral work at perhaps University of Chicago or University of Virginia. And what I really wanted to focus on was the Renaissance, Shakespeare and John Webster in particular, but also the fact that so many playwrights in England had Italian characters, Italian settings, Italian plots. And so I wanted to focus on the Italian influence on Renaissance writers.
Give us an example.
Oh, well, Romeo and Juliet's a classic. I mean,
of course.
It's set in Verona, and there were versions of Romeo and Juliet around long before Shakespeare wrote his. Othello, also The Merchant of Venice, all of those. John Webster's The Duchess of Malfi from the Amalfi Coast south of Rome. That is also set in Italy. And so there are quite a few Italian influences. And I just wondered why, in particular, Italy held such sway. And so what I wanted to do was learn Italian so that I could read Dante's Inferno and Boccaccio's Decameron in the original to kind of see what kind of literary, rhetorical influences they might have had. And when I did that, for example, Macbeth, which doesn't have much Italian influence at all,
Scotland.
Yeah, there's an entire scene where he's talking about whether he should do what he's going to do, Macbeth, that is, and it follows very closely Dante's Inferno, Book 34, when he's traveling across the frozen lake of Cocytus towards Satan himself, and he kind of makes that rhetorical journey in Macbeth in the same order that Dante put it. And so I didn't think that was an accident. And so it just seemed like it, more than just Italian plots, what were some of the ideas and themes and imagery from Italian literature that made it into English Renaissance?
In a sense, all literature, or at least all the literature that we kind of tend to talk about, seems to be about indecisions, right? Not having distinctions between good and bad and right and wrong and the to be or not to be kind of situation, right? So are you saying that this could have originated from a lot of Italian culture and literature?
Well, I think certainly those themes, I think, tend to be universal.
Oh, they're universal.
Yeah, and so, like in our classes, if anyone from 10th grade is listening to this, you know, we talked just last week about the fact that choices between good and evil are usually pretty easy. Choices between good and good are a lot more difficult, and you take a lot more time. And that's why we tend to turn what we know to be evil into something we can perceive at least momentarily as good, and then choose that. And so there's a lot of that in lots of plays, not just in Shakespeare and Webster and the Italian, but the way it's treated in terms of the imagery, that was what I was really, really interested in. How much of the English Renaissance authors were influenced by the way Italians in the 13th and 14th century had already kind of treated those topics, but obviously in a different way. Dante's Inferno is not a play. Macbeth is.
Now, you're steeped in all things Italian, and I have to tell listeners that one of the ways I stumbled upon Don's interest in all of this is I one day walked in. I was looking for a cup of coffee, and he seems to be a full-blown barista here. He's got an espresso machine. I said, wow, like, how did you get to this point? And then we talked about Italy and all of European influence. Let's move on to something that you teach. I'm sure if you're a listener, and by the way, I'm hoping students, you'll be listening because you will take a class similar to this. What would you say is your favorite book or favorite author that you deal with?
Well, it sounds kind of cheesy, but probably my favorite one is whatever we're reading right then. When we were reading Hamlet earlier in the year, I hadn't taught it in a very long time, and getting back into that was just amazing. It's what I did my master's thesis on, not Hamlet, but Shakespeare and John Webster. I mentioned him earlier. And so the Renaissance plays, the dramas, I really get into. We've now switched to Paradise Lost, which I hadn't read again in probably 32 years. And a lot of it is coming back to me, and so many of the lines. So in general, for study purposes, Renaissance literature is my favorite to take apart, to analyze, to dissect. I think there was just an amazing flowering, not only of knowledge and enlightenment, but also just the means of expressing it during that time period. The way Milton, who is restorational after the Renaissance, but various writers found ways to express themselves. I never get tired of that stuff. And when it comes to just reading for fun, I like early 20th century English novels, Evelyn Waugh, Graham Greene. I think those guys they really wrote engagingly. It's quick, it's fun. We'll get to some of that at the end of the year, something like it. But no, I really enjoy the literature of the first semester, the 16th and 17th centuries. That's what really, really I spend a lot of time on, and just really enjoy immersing myself in that.
I have to tell you a little bit of an aside here. My students, 7th graders, they're writing books now. The last project of the semester is they're creating e-books. You'd be surprised at some of the topics. Some of them are really serious. Some of them are, a lot of them are writing fiction. But one of the things I pulled out yesterday was Out of the Silent Planet, C.S. Lewis, so talking about British authors. Now, you might call him a modern writer, right? Because he writes science fiction. But it's just interesting how this guy, who, I shouldn't call him a guy, C.S. Lewis, this amazing, prolific writer, has written not just books on Christianity and on English literature, but he's also written fantastic books like this on with science fiction, and of course Narnia series is one of them. So how would you place a person like C.S. Lewis, and I'm talking specifically, maybe putting a plug in for this for their students, because I know they're going to read the book very soon, not in my class, but in the next semester. How would you place C.S. Lewis and you know, those books like Out of the Silent Planet and Perlander?
C.S. Lewis. I know that probably quite a few instructors here and students love C.S. Lewis. And it sounds, again, maybe it sounds a little corny or whatever, but he's almost in the class by himself. I almost think of him, the more I read him, as a sort of prophet more than just an author. If you read Screwtape Proposes a Toast, how the mantra of democracy can be get people to accept tyranny, I think, is just astounding. And he wrote it 70 years ago, long before social media and things of that sort created the conditions for which sort of political mantras could be repeated over and over again. If you look at Out of the Silent Planet, absolutely that trip to Mars and a fading planet that were two separate cultures coexisting but sort of on a planet that's going out. But then you read the next one, Perelandra, which is a sort of Garden of Eden story where Adam and Eve don't fall. What kind of world does that create? And I think Lewis looked at that notion very easily, but then very thoroughly. But then the last one in that science fiction trilogy, That Hideous Strength, talks about the fact that the people most fooled by the siren song of tyranny and oppression are the intellectuals and not the average Joes. That they're willing to buy into any idea because it confirms their biases, where the average person who goes to work every day is much more skeptical. And I just, so much of that seems to be coming to pass today. It's almost like he had some insight that others didn't have on where we were headed as a culture, because 60 years after he, you know, died, a lot of the things that he wrote about in the later years of his life just seemed to be coming to pass two generations after he was done. So he is, like I said, he's almost like in a class by himself with his literature, with his thoughts, with his radio shows back in the 40s and 50s, an amazing writer and thinker.
It seems like this podcast is now turning out to be, like I said, a discussion of literature, which is not bad, not a bad idea. Now, looking at, literature through the lens of C.S. Lewis and some of the other people you've talked about, this whole wrestling between good and evil, morality and, you know, like the morality plays and all of that, it's a universal theme, of course. But then C.S. Lewis, as you said, I like the way you put it, you're saying he is in a class by himself. And he's very prophetic. So he's almost as if things that are turning out right now in the age of social media, he foresaw this future.
We'll take a break and we'll be right back.
Enjoy what you're hearing? Want to have more Benjamin Franklin podcasts in your life? Then be sure to turn in to our other podcast, Fully Charged.
But now I want to move on to something else, and Don is also somebody who doesn't drive to work. He rides a bicycle. I noticed that there are two people in the school who ride bicycles to work. I just want to ask you about this. I never asked you this before. What made you so interested in coming to work on a bike?
Well, I love bikes. I've loved them since I was a little kid. I've never been into like BMX or bike racing, but I enjoy riding for fitness, because you can see a lot more of the world on a bike than just jogging. So I get kind of bored when I just go run. But also when we moved here, I only live about 3 miles away, and it seemed like a good distance to ride. It's a good way to wake up, and as Mr. Davis and Mr. Cook were actually saying this week regarding Salubritas, you know, a little exercise really gets you going and positive, and you get those happy chemicals, Davis called them this morning. You get, you know, a little positive energy going. And so I just really enjoyed it. When I went to Europe to go live in Italy, I took my guitar, which I play badly and you will never hear, and a bag of clothes and my mountain bike. And those are the three things that I took, basically.
You carried your bike with you?
I packed it up, I dismantled it, and shipped it in a box, and had it waiting at a train station when I found a place to live. And when I found a place to live, I went to the Innsbruck train station in Austria, where I had had it shipped, because it was kind of central, and went, got on a train and picked up my bike. And that was my mode of transportation pretty much everywhere I went in Aosta, Italy, was my, they don't even make them anymore, Bridgestone mountain bike. So I just love riding bikes. It's a great fitness thing. You get to see a lot, and it's, you know, think of my tiny carbon footprint too, I guess.
Wow. So I think this is a great place to end it, even though we can talk for longer, because I'm hoping, again, students are listening to this, and I'm hoping one day you might at least take away some points from Don, from Mr. Myers. Ride a bicycle, get those happy chemicals going, read literature, and if you can, sometime, spend a little time in Europe. You'd never regret it. We do have travel-related events here in Benjamin Franklin High School. There's a trip to Europe coming up soon. So on that note, thank you, Don, and I will end this with saying thank you guys for listening to Radio 201, the podcast from Benjamin Franklin High School. Again, this is your host, Angelo Fernando, and this is
Don Meyer. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.